This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource of pilots and aircraft owners.
Russ Niles reporting for AvWeb. We're with Mike Slack. He is one of the founding members of Slack & Davis. It's a Fort Worth law firm that specializes in aviation cases. And Mike, you provided a lot of the background information for a controversial story that appeared in USA Today recently. Got quite a reaction from the aviation community. Are you a pilot,
variation.
Mike?
Yeah, I fly. Okay. I fly regularly and often.
What do you fly?
I fly a Turbo 182, a recent model with glass cockpit, and I also have a T6, North American T6.
Okay, so I mean, you know about the culture of pilots, and that we are trained to look after business. When things go wrong, it's the pilot's responsibility. But
yep.
The whole tone of the USA Today story, and were you interviewed for it, or did they just use your cases?
We provided background information primarily. I was not involved other than, they contacted us, asked for background information on cases. We provided that. I was not interviewed.
Well, the tone of the story was that pilots are doing the best they can, but they have lousy equipment. And that there is almost a conspiracy to keep the equipment lousy. And what the groups have been saying is that there's an active movement afoot now to get everything modernized, and that part of the story was not included. I know you can't speak for the journalist involved, but I'm just wondering if
when you say active movement to get things modernized,
well, with the Part 23,
the new rules,
the Part 23 rewrite. And
right, but there are lots of things that have been in the works forever. I mean, so has Next Gen. It's been in the works forever. I mean, there's always something down the line in aviation, but I think USA Today looked at where we are today looking back. But I agree that not everything futuristic was discussed in the article, but I don't think there's anything necessarily in new rules that's a prescription for changing some of the problems that USA pointed to. I mean, there's been some resistance to some of the new rule changes from manufacturers. Gamma's been, involved in resisting some of the proposed changes. The bottom line is there's nothing that we can look at right now to say, yeah, there's something in those rules that if they were adopted today would change. For example, one of the criticisms, which is the way in general aviation cases the NTSB investigates.
Or doesn't investigate.
Yeah, but the party system, basically. And the problems that come with it. Single investigator, multiple representatives by manufacturers, component and airframe, limited resources, limited time, file closed, pilot error. And one of the things that strikes me as strange is that pilots get up in arms when an article like USA Today comes out, when actually pilots, I think, tend to have a unquestioning faith in their aircraft and tend not to ask critical questions about the way the equipment works. I mean, if I'm a pilot and I see USA Today, I want to start asking questions about the process. I want to know, do manufacturers really work to suppress changes? The answer is, yeah, in some cases they do. Some instances they actively resist making change that would enhance safety.
Well, the Cessna 182 you fly, and we won't even talk about the T6, is a 50-year-old design with a list of ADs as long as both of your arms. It has been the subject of many safety-related recalls, if you'd like, in which the manufacturers had to fix it. What's the alternative to the system that we have?
Well, it depends on what part of the system you want to discuss. If you want to discuss the NTSB method of investigating general aviation crashes, there can be more inclusion representation during an investigation. There's room for designating a representative that's not affiliated with a manufacturer. There are plenty of qualified people to fulfill that role. Why does it always have to be manufacturers, employees that are assisting the NTSB?
Okay, so why
don't we let the manufacturers contribute to a fund instead of paying salaried people, contribute to a fund that goes towards independent investigators assisting the NTSB?
Okay, but I think where I was headed with the last comment or question was, here we have this airplane that has a very long list of known safety issues, and you bought one anyway. Why?
Well, what I bought, no, I bought a 2009. I didn't buy a 59. I bought a 2009. I bought a 2009, which I researched. Now, I'm not saying that airplane's without flaws, but it's an airplane that's relatively forgiving. It's got a decent record, safety record, in terms of outcomes with a variety of flight developments, circumstances. And so it had an overall satisfactory safety rating for me, and it fit my experience and flying profile. Now, can I be assured that there's not something lurking in that airplane? No, but then again, that airplane gets more TLC than the average pilot gives their airplane. It gets a whole lot of attention. Thing goes in for 25-hour oil changes. We sample the oil. There's not a software update that we don't do immediately. We check it after every maintenance flight. My maintenance guy flies as a passenger with a pilot that I hire to fly that airplane after every maintenance flight. So maybe it has something to do with the way I operate my airplane.
Okay, but the crux of the story was that pilot error is not or operator error is not the problem. The equipment
is
the problem.
No, that's not the story. The story said that pilot error doesn't account for as many of the occurrences as it is cited for. It's not the not the proposition you suggest at all. It was that the pilot error is cited too many times.
When it's in fact the airplane.
When it's something else,
airplane
component, right?
Okay, so what's a typical flight for you? Do you use it for business or for pleasure?
Both. I typically fly the Skylane inside of 300 miles. I always fly at IFR. It may be a beautiful day, but I always fly IFR. So it's. It's usually a flight 8,000 to 10,000 feet. I'm particular about weather. I watch my weather. I've always got southwest if I need to go, and it's not a good day to fly.
So what's the takeaway from the USA Today article and from your perspective? I mean, you've done a lot of these cases.
My takeaway is the same as the article, that pilot error is all too frequently the what is written down as the cause of a crash. And the other takeaway is that what the NTSB analysis never really gets into is what we call true causation. Just take the Robinson helicopter cases. Most of the Robinson post-crash fires occurred in instances where there was a low deceleration impact. It was usually the responsibility of the pilot. But there would be no injuries to speak of in the absence of the fire. The cause of the fire is the exploding fuel tank. The cause of the low G impact is typically the pilot. So we look at it in a broader way. We look at the complete causal chain from the beginning of the incident to the final outcome. NTSB doesn't take that perspective. We also work in a much more detailed environment. I got 6 or 8 lawyers on the other side picking over my case. They're looking at every piece of evidence. We go test, we retest, they scrutinize, I scrutinize. and then we present our case. NTSB doesn't have to do that. Usually they got a manufacturer whispering in their ear.
Okay.
They don't have to go in front of a judge. They don't have to go in front of adversarial counsel that's going to ask hard questions. Our stuff gets picked over pretty hard. And so the amount of examination of the evidence can be far, far more exhausting in a legal case than it is in an NTSB investigation, particularly one that gets delegated. And you got a manufacturer, I can cite you this case, I can give you the testimony, you got a manufacturer driving the FAA designee, they get to the scene and the manufacturer's representative steers them away from the witness that says, that would have said, no, the guy that you think did the repairs did not do the repairs. So all that kind of stuff plays into corrupted reports.
What's a first step? What would you like, everything starts with a first step.
I think first of all, understand the difference between what the NTSB does and what I do, okay? But when it comes to the NTSB investigation, understand what it is, and I think one positive change would be what I suggested, which is to take another look at the party system and get the fox out of the chicken house. You know, and there needs to be more enforcement of the terms upon which people participate in an NTSB investigation. When they sign that piece of paper that said they're doing a safety investigation, they should be prohibited from that time forward from sharing any information with lawyers or insurance people on their side of the case. If it's going to be a safety investigation, it needs to be that, but they shouldn't be looking back to the home office for smoke signals on what to tell the NTSB guy. I've made manufacturers, investigators liars, okay? And I can send you the testimony if you want to see it, where they were caught lying, where they were caught manipulating photographs, where they were caught cheating in the investigation, and they get caught and they look bad. I've seen the sweat on their forehead. I've seen the red faces. But, you know, something's got to change. Something's got to break that up.
Okay, so what the manufacturers say or have said and have actually demonstrated is that in this litigious environment, they can't afford to do business. If that's the way it's going to be, if they're going to be held to those sorts of standards, then they're out
of business.
They've
been selling that lie since dinosaurs, okay? They can sell safety. They can make their airplanes safer. They have fewer wrecks. Safety actually will cost less. But they've never been able to show the evidence that how they litigation is costing them out of business. They got much bigger problems with inefficiencies and their inability to innovate and sell aircraft. I guarantee you that's been debunked over and over and over. They've never, ever been able to come up with litigation is costing me X. Usually it's bad business practices, lack of innovation. Deferring safety improvements becomes far more costly at the end if you don't get to them early.
But isn't the FAA a party to that? Isn't the certification process so onerous for changes to airplanes that it becomes untenable for
I don't think so. I disagree with that. I think that some of those changes, most of the time, if they want to make a change, they make the change under an existing type certificate. Some of the new aircraft, and primarily with manufacturers that don't have any products in the market, it's been a little challenging. But I think that that's an overused excuse. The manufacturers, I think, can be more proactive in making design changes and making them in places where they can do it on existing type certificates. I think one of the things that with pilots in particular is that many times the pilot reaction to stories like USA Today or stories about crashes, it's built around a survival instinct. Airplane crashes, kills a pilot, and the assumption is that must not be the pilot I am, but particularly when they see that pilot is flying the same kind of airplane they fly. They don't like to believe that airplane may suffer from some of the problems from certain problems, because that could put them at risk. So when an article like USA Today comes out and they see airplanes and products mentioned that they may have flown, there's going to be a reaction to, well, there must be something wrong with this story because I fly that airplane and I don't think that would have happened to me. It's a survival reaction. So I think we also need to look at the audience and the reaction and to appreciate why the reaction may be what it is.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time today, Mike. Russ Niles reporting for AvWeb. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine. For more information on Aviation Consumer, log on to www.aviationconsumer.com.